Mr. Morton. You can save your outrage for when you go outside and talk to the reporters yourself, which I know you'll do. What about that last page? He mentions the children. His children. What does that mean?
I have no idea.
He obviously was emotionally distraught when he wrote this. It may mean nothing. Bosch remained standing, studying the attorney. Why did he call you last night?
Why do you think?
To tell me you had been here, that it was all over the news, that his boss had seen it and wanted to fire him. Did he say whether he buried that boy up there on the hill?
Morton put on the best indignant look he could muster.
He certainly said that he did not have a thing to do with it. He believed he was being persecuted for a past mistake, a very distant mistake, and I'd say he was correct about that.
Bosch nodded.
Okay, Mr. Morton. You can leave now.
What are you talking about? I'm not going to...
This house is now a crime scene. We are investigating your client's death to confirm or deny it was by his own hand. You're no longer welcome here. Jerry?
Edgar stepped over to the couch and waved Morton up.
Come on. Time to go out there and get your face on TV. It'll be good for business, right?
Morton stood up and left in a huff. Bosch walked over to the front windows and pulled the curtain back a few inches. When Morton came down the side of the house to the driveway, he immediately walked to the center of the knot of reporters and started talking angrily. Bosch couldn't hear what was said. He didn't need to. When Edgar came back into the room, Bosch told him to call the watch office and get a patrol car up to Wonderland for crowd control. He had a feeling that the media mob, like a virus replicating itself, was going to start growing bigger and hungrier by the minute.
Chapter 19. They found Nicholas Trent's children when they searched his home following the removal of his body. Filling the entire two drawers of a small desk in the living room, a desk Bosch had not searched the night before, were files, photographs, and financial records, including several thick bank envelopes containing canceled checks. Trent had been sending small amounts of money on a monthly basis to a number of charitable organizations that fed and clothed children. From Appalachia to the Brazilian rainforest to Kosovo, Trent had been sending checks for years. Bosch found no check for an amount higher than $12. He found dozens and dozens of photographs of the children he was supposedly helping, as well as small handwritten notes from them. Bosch had seen any number of public service ads for the charities on late-night television. He had always been suspicious. Not about whether a few dollars could keep a child from going hungry and unclothed, but about whether the few dollars would actually get to them. He wondered if the photos Trent kept in the drawers of his desk were the same stock shot sent to everybody who contributed. He wondered if the thank-you notes in childish printing were fake.
"Man," Edgar said as he surveyed the contents of the desk. "This guy, it's like I think he was paying a penance or something. Sending all his cash to these outfits."
"Yeah? A penance for what?"
"We may never know."
Edgar went back to searching the second bedroom. Bosch studied some of the photos he had spread on the top of the desk. There were boys and girls, none looking older than 10, though this was hard to estimate because they all had the hollow and ancient eyes of children who have been through war and famine and indifference. He picked up one shot of a young white boy and turned it over. The information said the boy had been orphaned during the fighting in Kosovo. He had been injured in the mortar blast that killed his parents. His name was Miloš Fidor, and he was 10 years old. Bosch had been orphaned at age 11. He looked into the boy's eyes and saw his own. At 4 p.m., they locked Trent's home and took three boxes of seized materials to the car. A small group of reporters lingered outside during the whole afternoon, despite word from media relations that all information on the day's events would be distributed through Parker Center. The reporters approached them with questions, but Bosch quickly said he was not allowed to comment on the investigation. They put the boxes in the trunk and drove off,
heading downtown, where a meeting had been called by Deputy Chief Irvin Irving. Bosch was uncomfortable with himself as he drove. He was ill at ease because Trent's suicide, and he had no doubts now that it was, had served to deflect the forward movement of the investigation of the boy's death. Bosch had spent half the day going through Trent's belongings when what he had wanted to be doing was nailing down the ID of the boy, running out the lead he had received in the call-in reports.
"What's the matter, Harry?"
Edgar asked at one point on the drive.
"What?"
"I don't know. You're acting all morose. I know that's probably your natural disposition, but you usually don't show it so much." Edgar smiled, but didn't get one in return from Bosch. "I'm just thinking about things. This guy might be alive today if we had handled things differently."
"Come on, Harry. You mean like if we didn't investigate him? There was no way. We did our job and things ran their course. Nothing we could do. If anybody's responsible, it's Thornton, and he's going to get his due. But if you ask me, the world's better off without somebody like Trent in it anyway. My conscience is clear, man. Crystal clear."
"Good for you." Bosch thought about his decision to give Edgar the day off on Sunday. If he hadn't done that, Edgar might have been the one to make the computer runs on the names. Kiz Ryder would have been out of the loop, and the information would have never gotten to Thornton. He sighed. Everything always seemed to work on a domino theory. If, then, if, then, if, then.
"What's your gut say on this guy?" he asked Edgar.
"You mean, like, did he do the boy on the hill?"
Bosch nodded.
"I don't know," Edgar said. "Have to see what the lab says about the dirt and the sister says about the skateboard. If it is the sister and we get an ID."
Bosch didn't say anything. But he always felt uncomfortable about relying on lab reports and determining which way to go with an investigation.
"What about you, Harry?"
Bosch thought of the photos of all the children Trent thought he was caring for. His act of contrition. His chance at redemption.
"I'm thinking we're spinning our wheels," he said.
"He isn't the guy."
Chapter 20. Deputy Chief Irvin Irving sat behind his desk in his spacious office on the 6th floor of Parker Center. Also seated in the room were Lieutenant Grace Billets, Bosch and Edgar, and an officer from the Media Relations Unit named Sergio Medina. Irving's adjutant, a female lieutenant named Simonton, stood in the open doorway of the office in case she was needed. Irving had a glass-topped desk. There was nothing on it except for two pieces of paper with printing on them that Bosch could not read from his spot in front of Irving's desk and to the left.
"Now then," Irving began, "what do we know as fact about Mr. Trent? We know he was a pedophile with a criminal record of abusing a child. We know that he lived a stone's throw from the burial site of a murdered child. And we know that he committed suicide on the evening he was questioned by investigators in regard to the first two points just stated." Irving picked up one of the pages on his desk and studied it without sharing its contents with the room. Finally, he spoke. "I have here a press release that states those same three facts and goes on to say, Mr. Trent is the subject of an ongoing investigation. Determination of whether he was responsible for the death of the victim found buried near his home is pending lab work and follow-up investigation." He looked at the page silently again, and then finally put it down. "Nice and succinct. But it will do little to quell the thirst of the media for this story, or to help us avert another troubling situation for this department." Bosch cleared his throat. Irving seemed to ignore it at first, but then spoke without looking at the detective.
"Yes, Detective Bosch?"
"Well, it sort of seems as though you're not satisfied with that. The problem is, what is on that press release is exactly where we stand. I'd love to tell you I think the guy did the kid on the hill. I'd love to tell you I know he did it. But we are a long way from that, and if anything, I think we're going to end up concluding the opposite."
"Based on what?" Irving snapped.
It was becoming clear to Bosch what the purpose of the meeting was. He guessed that the second page on Irving's desk was the press release the deputy chief wanted to put out. It probably pinned everything on Trent and called his suicide the result of his knowing he would be found out. This would allow the department to handle Thornton, the leaker, quietly, outside of the magnifying glass of the press. It would spare the department the humiliation of acknowledging that a leak of confidential information from one of its officers caused a possibly innocent man to kill himself. It would also allow them to close the case of the boy on the hill. Bosch understood that everyone sitting in the room knew that closing a case of this nature was the longest of long shots. The case had drawn growing media attention, and Trent, with his suicide, had now presented them with a way out. Suspicions could be cast on the dead pedophile, and the department could call it a day and move on to the next case, hopefully one with a better chance of being solved. Bosch could understand this, but not accept it. He had seen the bones. He had heard Gallagher run down the litany of injuries. In that autopsy suite, Bosch had resolved to find the killer and close the case. The expediency of department politics and image management would be second to that. He reached into his coat pocket and pulled out his notebook. He opened it to a page with a folded corner and looked at it as if he was studying a page full of notes. But there was only one notation on the page, written on Saturday in the autopsy suite. 44 separate indications of trauma. His eyes held on the number he had written until Irving spoke again. Detective Bosch? I asked, based on what? Bosch looked up and closed the notebook. Based on the timing. We don't think Trent moved into that neighborhood until after that boy was in the ground, and on the analysis of the bones. This kid was physically abused over a long period of time, from when he was a small child. It doesn't add up to Trent. Analysis of both the timing and the bones will not be conclusive, Irving said. No matter what they tell us, there is still a possibility, no matter how slim, that Nicholas Trent was the perpetrator of this crime. A very slim possibility. What about the search of Trent's home today? We took some old work boots with dried mud in the treads. It'll be compared to soil samples taken where the bones were found. But they'll be just as inconclusive. Even if they match up, Trent could have picked up the dirt hiking behind his house. It's all part of the same sediment, geologically speaking. What else? Not much. We've got a skateboard. A skateboard? Bosch explained about the call-in tip he had not had time to follow up on because of the suicide. As he told it, he could see Irving warming to the possibility that a skateboard in Trent's possession could be linked to the bones on the hill. I want that to be your priority, he said. I want that nailed down, and I want to know it the moment you do. Bosch only nodded. Yes, sir, Billets threw in. Irving went silent and studied the two pages on his desk. Finally, he picked up the one he had not read from. The page Bosch guessed was the loaded press release, and turned in his desk. He slid it into a shredder, which whined loudly as it destroyed the document. He then turned back to his desk and picked up the remaining document. Officer Medina, you may put this out to the press. He handed the document to Medina, who stood up to receive it. Irving checked his watch. Just in time for the 6 o'clock news, he said. Sir, Medina said. Yes. There have been many inquiries about the erroneous reports on Channel 4. Should we... Say it is against policy to comment on any internal investigation. You may also add that the department will not condone or accept the leaking of confidential information to the media. That is all, Officer Medina. Medina looked like he had another question to ask, but knew better. He nodded and left the office. Irving nodded to his adjutant, and she closed the office door, remaining in the anteroom outside. The deputy chief then turned his head, looking from Billets, to Edgar, to Bosch. We have a delicate situation here, he said. Are we clear on how we are proceeding? Yes, Billets and Edgar said in unison. Bosch said nothing. Irving looked at him.
Detective, do you have something to say?
Bosch thought a moment before answering. I just want to say that I'm going to find out who killed that boy and put him up in that hole. If it's Trent, fine. Good. But if it's not him, I'm going to keep going.
Irving saw something on his desk. Something small, like a hair or other near microscopic particle. Something Bosch couldn't see. Irving picked it up with two fingers and dropped it into the trash can behind him. As he brushed his fingers together over the shredder, Bosch looked on and wondered if the demonstration was some sort of threat directed at him.
Not every case is solved, Detective. Not every case is solvable, he said. At some point, our duties may require us to move on to more pressing matters.
Are you giving me a deadline?
No, Detective. I am saying I understand you, and I just hope you understand me.
What's going to happen with Thornton?
It's under internal review. I can't discuss it with you at this time.
Bosch shook his head in frustration.
Watch yourself, Detective Bosch, Irving said curtly. I've shown a lot of patience with you, on this case and others before it.
What Thornton did jammed up this case. He should...
If he is responsible, he'll be dealt with accordingly. But keep in mind, he was not operating in a vacuum. He needed to get the information in order to leak it. The investigation is ongoing.
Bosch stared at Irving. The message was clear. Kiz Ryder could go down with Thornton if Bosch didn't fall into step with Irving's march.
You read me, Detective?
I read you. Loud and clear.
Chapter 21. Before taking Edgar back to Hollywood Division and then heading out to Venice, Bosch got the evidence box containing the skateboard out of the trunk and took it back inside Parker Center to the SID lab. At the counter, he asked for Antoine Jesper. While he waited, he studied the skateboard. It appeared to be made out of laminated plywood. It had a lacquered finish to which several decals had been applied. Most notably a skull and crossbones located in the middle of the top surface of the board. When Jesper came to the counter, Bosch presented him with the evidence box.
I want to know who made this, when it was made, and where it was sold, he said. It's priority one. I got the sixth floor riding my back on this case.
No problem. I can tell you the make right now. It's a bony board. They don't make them anymore. He sold out and moved, I think, to Hawaii.
How do you know all of that?
'Cause when I was a kid, I was a boarder, and this was what I wanted but never had the dough for.
Pretty ironic, huh?
What is?
A bony board in the case?
You know, bones.
Bosch nodded. Whatever. I want whatever you can get me by tomorrow.
I can try. I can't promise
tomorrow, Antoine. The sixth floor, remember? I'll be talking to you tomorrow.
Jesper nodded.
Give me the morning, at least.
You got it.
Anything happening with documents?
Jesper shook his head.
Nothing yet. She tried the dyes and nothing came up. I don't think you should count on anything there, Harry.
All right, Antoine.
Bosch left him there holding the box. On the way back to Hollywood, he let Edgar drive while he pulled the tip sheet out of his briefcase and called Sheila Delacroix on his cell phone. She answered promptly, and Bosch introduced himself and said her call had been referred to him.
Was it Arthur? She asked urgently.
We don't know, ma'am. That's why I'm calling.
Oh.
Will it be possible for me and my partner to come see you tomorrow morning to talk about Arthur and get some information? It will help us to be better able to determine if the remains are those of your brother.
I understand.
Yes. You can come here if that is convenient.
Where is there, ma'am?
Oh, at my home, off Wilshire in the Miracle Mile.
Bosch looked at the address on the call-in sheet. On Orange Grove.
Yes, that's correct.
Is 8:30 too early for you?
That would be fine, officer. If I can help, I would like to. It just bothers me to think that that man lived there all those years after doing something like this, even if the victim wasn't my brother. Bosch decided it wasn't worth telling her that Trent was probably completely innocent in terms of the bone case. There were too many people in the world who believed everything they saw on television. Instead, Bosch gave her his cell phone number and told her to call it if something came up, and 8:30 the next morning turned out to be a bad time for her. "It won't be a bad time," she said. "I want to help. If it's Arthur, I want to know. Part of me wants it to be him, so I know it is over. But the other part wants it to be somebody else. That way I can keep thinking he's out there someplace. Maybe with a family of his own now."
"I understand," Bosch said. "We'll see you in the morning."
Chapter 22. It was a brutal drive to Venice, and Bosch arrived more than a half hour late. His lateness was then compounded by his fruitless search for a parking space before he went back to the library lot in defeat. His delay was no bother to Julia Brasher, who was in the critical stage of putting things together in the kitchen. She instructed him to go to the stereo and put on some music, then pour himself a glass of wine from the bottle that was already open on the coffee table. She did not make a move to touch him or kiss him, but her manner was completely warm. He thought things seemed good, that maybe he had gotten past the gaffe of the night before. He chose a CD of live recordings of the Bill Evans Trio at the Village Vanguard in New York. He had the CD at home and knew it would make for quiet dinner music. He poured himself a glass of red wine and casually walked around the living room, looking at the things she had on display. The mantle of the white brick fireplace was crowded with small framed photos he hadn't gotten a chance to look at the night before. Some were propped on stands and displayed more prominently than others. Not all were of people. Some photos were of places he assumed she had visited in her travels. There was a ground shot of a live volcano billowing smoke and spewing molten debris in the air. There was an underwater shot of the gaping mouth and jagged teeth of a shark. The killer fish appeared to be launching itself right at the camera, and whoever was behind it. At the edge of the photo, Bosch could see one of the iron bars of the cage the photographer, who he assumed was Brasher, had been protected by. There was a photo of Brasher with two Aboriginal men on either side of her standing somewhere, Bosch assumed, in the Australian outback. And there were several other photos of her with what appeared to be fellow backpackers in other locations of exotic or rugged terrain that Bosch could not readily identify. In none of the photos in which Julia was a subject was she looking at the camera. Her eyes were always staring off in the distance, or at one of the other individuals posed with her. In the last position on the mantel, as if hidden behind the other photos, was a small gold-framed shot of a much younger Julia Brasher with a slightly older man. Bosch reached behind the photos and lifted it out so he could see it better. The couple was sitting at a restaurant, or perhaps a wedding reception. Julia wore a beige gown with a low-cut neckline. The man wore a tuxedo. "You know, this man is a god in Japan," Julia called from the kitchen. Bosch put the framed photo back in its place and walked to the kitchen. Her hair was down, and he couldn't decide which way he liked it best.
"Bill Evans?"
"Yeah. It seems like they have whole channels of the radio dedicated to playing his music."
"Don't tell me. You spend some time in Japan, too."
"About 2 months. It's a fascinating place."
It looked to Bosch like she was making a risotto with chicken and asparagus in it. "Smells good."
"Thank you. I hope it is."
"So what do you think you were running from?"
She looked up at him from her work at the stove. A hand held a stirring spoon steady.
"What?" "You know, all the travel. Leaving Daddy's law firm to go swim with sharks and dive into volcanoes. Was it the old man or the law firm the old man ran?"
"Some people would look at it as maybe I was running towards something."
"The guy in the tuxedo?"
"Harry, take your gun off. Leave your badge at the door. I always do."
"Sorry."
She went back to work at the stove, and Bosch came up behind her, He put his hands on her shoulders and pushed his thumbs into the indentations of her upper spine. She offered no resistance. Soon he felt her muscles begin to relax. He noticed her empty wine glass on the counter. "I'll go get the wine." He came back with his glass and the bottle. He refilled her glass, and she picked it up and clicked it off the side of his. "Whether to something or away from something, here's to running," she said. "Just running." "What happened to hold fast?"
"There's that, too."
"Here's to forgiveness and reconciliation." They clicked glasses again. He came around behind her and started working her neck again.
"You know, I thought about your story all last night after you left," she said.
"My story?"
"About the bullet in the tunnel?"
"And?" She shrugged her shoulders.
"Nothing. It's just amazing, that's all.
You know, after that day, I wasn't afraid anymore when I went down in the darkness. I just knew that I was going to make it through. I can't explain why. I just knew. Which, of course, was stupid, because there are no guarantees of that. Back then and there or anywhere else. It made me sort of reckless." He held his hands steady for a moment. "It's not good to be too reckless," he said. "You cross the tube too often, you'll eventually get burned."
"Hmm. Are you lecturing me, Harry? Do you want to be my training officer now?"
"No. I checked my gun and my badge at the door, remember?"
"Okay, then."
She turned around, his hand still on her neck, and kissed him. Then she pulled back away.
"You know, the great thing about this risotto is that it can keep in the oven as long as we need it to."
Bosch smiled. Later on, after they had made love, Bosch got up from her bed and went out to the living room.
"Where are you going?" she called after him.
When he didn't answer, she called out to him to turn the oven up. He came back into the room carrying the gold-framed photo. He got into the bed and turned on the light on the bed table. It was a low wattage bulb beneath a heavy lampshade. The room still was cast in shadow.
"Harry? What are you doing?"
Julia said in a tone that warned he was treading close to her heart.
"Did you turn the oven up?"
"Yeah. 350. Tell me about this guy."
"Why?"
"I just want to know."
"It's a private story."
"I know.
But you can tell me."
She tried to take the photo away, but he held it out of her reach. "Is he the one? Did he break your heart and send you running?"
"Harry, I thought you took your badge off."
"I did. And my clothes, everything." She smiled.
"Well, I'm not telling you anything."
She was on her back, head propped on a pillow. Bosch put the picture on the bed table and then turned back and moved in next to her. Under the sheet, he put his arm across her body and pulled her tightly to him. "Look, you want to trade scars again? I got my heart broken twice by the same woman, and you know what? I kept her picture on a shelf in my living room for a long time. Then, on New Year's Day, I decided it had been a long enough time. I put her picture away. Then I got called out to work, and I met you." She looked at him, her eyes moving slightly back and forth as she seemed to be searching his face for something, maybe the slightest hint of insincerity.
"Yes," she finally said. "He broke my heart. Okay?"
"No, not okay. Who is the creep?" She started laughing.
"Harry, you're my knight in tarnished armor, aren't you?"
She pulled herself up into a sitting position, the sheet falling away from her breasts. She folded her arms across them.
"He was in the firm.
I really fell for him. Right down the old elevator shaft. And then?
Then he decided it was over.
And he decided to betray me and to tell secret things to my father. What things?
She shook her head.
Things I will never tell a man again.
Where was that picture taken?
Oh, at a firm function. Probably the New Year's banquet. I don't remember. They have a lot of them.
Bosch had become angled behind her. He leaned down and kissed her back, just above the tattoo.
I couldn't be there anymore while he was there, so I quit. I said I wanted to travel. My father thought it was a midlife crisis because I had turned 30. I just let him think it. But then I had to do what I said I wanted to do. Travel. I went to Australia first. It was the farthest place I could think of.
Bosch pulled himself up and stacked two pillows behind his back. He then pulled her back against his chest. He kissed the top of her head and kept his nose in her hair.
I had a lot of money from the firm, she said. I didn't have to worry. I just kept traveling, going wherever I wanted, working odd jobs when I felt like it. I didn't come home for almost 4 years. And when I did, that's when I joined the academy. I was walking along the boardwalk and saw the little Venice Community Service office. I went in and picked up a pamphlet. It all happened pretty fast after that.
Your history shows impulsive and possibly reckless decision-making processes. How did that get by the screeners?
She gently elbowed him in the side, setting off a flare of pain from his ribs. He tensed. Oh, Harry, sorry, I forgot.
Yeah, sure. She laughed.
I guess all you old guys know that the department's been pushing big time for what they term mature women cadets the last few years, to smooth off all the hard testosterone edges of the department.
She rocked her hips back against Bosch's genitals to underline the point.
And speaking of testosterone, she said, you never told me how it went with old Bullethead himself today.
Bosch groaned but didn't answer.
You know, she said, Irving came to address our class one day on the moral responsibilities that come with carrying the badge. And everybody sitting there knew the guy probably makes more backroom deals up there on the sixth floor than there are days in the year. The guy's the classic fixer. He could practically cut the irony in the auditorium with a knife. Her use of the word irony made Bosch flash on what Antoine Jesper had said about coupling the bones found on the hill with the bones on the skateboard. He felt his body tensing as thoughts of the case started encroaching on what had been an oasis of respite from the investigation. She sensed his tightness. What is it?
Nothing.
You got all tense all of a sudden.
The case, I guess.
She was quiet a moment. I think it's kind of amazing, she then said. Those bones being up there all of these years and then coming up out of the ground. Like a ghost or something.
It's a city of bones. And all of them are waiting to come up.
He paused.
I don't want to talk about Irving or the bones or the case or anything else right now.
Then what do you want?
He didn't answer.
She turned to face him and started pushing him down off the pillows until he was flat on his back. How about a mature woman to smooth off all the hard edges again?
It was impossible for Bosch not to smile.
Chapter 23.
Before dawn, Bosch was on the road. He left Julia Brasher sleeping in her bed and started on his way to his home after first stopping at Abbott's Habit for a coffee to go. Venice was like a ghost town, with the tendrils of the morning fog moving across the streets. But as he got closer to Hollywood, the lights of cars on the streets multiplied, and Bosch was reminded that the City of Bones was a 24-hour city. At home, he showered and put on fresh clothes. He then climbed back into his car and went down the hill to Hollywood Division. It was 7:30 when he got there. Surprisingly, a number of detectives were already in place, chasing paperwork and cases. Edgar wasn't among them. Bosch put his briefcase down and walked to the watch office to get coffee and to see if any citizen had brought in donuts. Almost every day, a John Q, who still kept the faith, brought in donuts for the division. A little way of saying there were still those out there who knew, or at least understood, the difficulties of the job. Every day in every division, cops put on the badge and tried to do their best in a place where the populace didn't understand them, didn't particularly like them, and in many instances outright despised them. Bosch always thought it was amazing how far a box of donuts could go in undoing that. He poured a cup and dropped a dollar in the basket. He took a sugar donut out of a box on the counter that had already been decimated by the patrol guys. No wonder. They were from Bob's Donuts in the farmer's market. He noticed Mankiewicz sitting at his desk, his dark eyebrows forming a deep V as he studied what looked like a deployment chart. "Hey, Mank, I think we pulled the grade A lead off the call-in sheets. Thought you'd want to know." Mankiewicz answered without looking up. "Good. Let me know when my guys can give it a rest. We're going to be short on the desk the next few days." Bosch knew this meant he was juggling personnel. When there weren't enough uniforms to put in cars, due to vacations, court appearances, or sick-outs, the watch sergeant always pulled people off the desk and put them on wheels. "You got it." Edgar still wasn't at the table when Bosch got back to the detective squad room. Bosch put his coffee and donut down next to one of the selectrics and went to get a search warrant application out of a community file drawer. For the next 15 minutes, he typed out an addendum to the search warrant he had already delivered to the records custodian at Queen of Angels. It asked for all records from the care of Arthur Delacroix, circa 1975 to 1985. When he was finished, he took it to the fax machine and sent it to the office of Judge John A. Houghton, who had signed all the hospital search warrants the day before. He added a note requesting that the judge review the addendum application as soon as possible, because it might lead to the positive identification of the bones, and therefore swing the investigation into focus. Bosch returned to the table, and from a drawer pulled out the stack of missing person reports he had gathered while fishing in the archives. He started looking through them quickly, glancing only at the box reserved for the name of the missing individual. In 10 minutes he was finished. There had been no report in the stack about Arthur Delacroix. He didn't know what this meant, but he planned to ask the boy's sister about it. It was now 8 o'clock, and Bosch was ready to leave to visit the sister. But still, no Edgar. Bosch ate the remainder of his donut and decided to give his partner 10 minutes to show before he would leave on his own. He had worked with Edgar for more than 10 years and still was bothered by his partner's lack of punctuality. It was one thing to be late for dinner. It was another to be late for a case. He had always taken Edgar's tardiness as a lack of commitment to their mission as homicide investigators. His direct line rang, and Bosch answered it with an annoyed rasp, expecting it to be Edgar announcing he was running late. But it wasn't Edgar. It was Julia Brasher. "So you just leave a woman high and dry in bed, huh?" Bosch smiled, and his frustration with Edgar quickly drained away. "I got a busy day here," he said. "I had to get going." "I know, but you could have said goodbye." Bosch saw Edgar making his way through the squad room. He wanted to get going before Edgar started his coffee, donut, and sports page ritual. "Well, I'm saying goodbye now, okay? I'm in the middle of something here, and I gotta run."
"Harry, what? I thought you were going to hang up on me or something."
"I'm not, but I gotta go."
"Look, come by before you go up for roll call, okay?"
"I'll probably be back by then."
"All right. I'll see you."
Bosch hung up and stood up just as Edgar got to the homicide table and dropped the folded sports page at his spot. "You ready?"
"Yeah, I was just going to get..."
"Let's go. I don't want to keep the lady waiting. And she'll probably have coffee there." On the way out, Bosch checked the incoming tray on the fax machine. His search warrant addendum had been signed and returned by Judge Houghton. "We're in business," Bosch said to Edgar, showing him the warrant as they walked to the car. "See? You come in early, you get stuff done."
"What's that supposed to mean? Is that a crack on me?"
It means what it means, I guess.
I just want some coffee.
Chapter 24 Sheila Delacroix lived in a part of the city called the Miracle Mile. It was a neighborhood south of Wilshire that wasn't quite up to the standards of nearby Hancock Park, but was lined with nicely kept homes and duplexes with modest stylistic adjustments to promote individuality. Delacroix's home was the second floor of a duplex with pseudo-Beaux-Arts styling. She invited the detectives into her home in a friendly manner, but when the first question Edgar asked was about coffee, she said it was against her religion. She offered tea, and Edgar reluctantly accepted. Bosch passed. He wondered which religion outlawed coffee. They took seats in the living room while the woman made Edgar his tea in the kitchen. She called out to them, saying she only had an hour and then had to leave for work. "What is it you do?" Bosch asked as she came out with a mug of hot tea, the tag from the tea bag looped over the side. She put it down on a coaster on a side table next to Edgar. She was a tall woman. She was slightly overweight, with blonde hair cut short. Bosch thought she wore too much makeup. "I'm a casting agent," she said, as she took a seat on the couch. "Mostly independent films, some episodic television. I'm actually casting a cop show this week." Bosch watched Edgar sip some tea and make a face. He then held the mug so he could read the teabag tag. "It's a blend," Delacroix said. "Strawberry and Darjeeling. Do you like it?" Edgar put the mug down on its coaster. "It's fine." "Miss Delacroix, if you're in the entertainment business, did you by any chance know Nicholas Trent?"
"Please, just call me Sheila."
"Now, that name, Nicholas Trent, it sounds familiar, but I can't quite place it. Is he an actor or is he in casting?" "Neither. He's the man who lived up on Wonderland. He was a set designer. I mean decorator."
"Oh, the one on TV, the man who killed himself. Oh, no wonder it was familiar."
"So you didn't know him from the business, then?"
"No, not at all."
"Okay, well, I shouldn't have asked that. We're out of order here. Let's just start with your brother. Tell us about Arthur. Do you have a picture we can look at?"
"Yes," she said, as she stood up and walked behind his chair. "Here he is."
She went to a waist-high cabinet Bosch hadn't noticed behind him. There were framed photos on it, displayed in much the same way he had seen the photos on Julia Brasher's mantle. Delacroix chose one and turned around and handed it to Bosch. The frame contained a photo of a boy and a girl sitting on a set of stairs Bosch recognized as the stairs they had climbed before knocking on her door. The boy was much smaller than the girl. Both were smiling at the camera and had the smiles of children who have been told to smile. A lot of teeth, but not a legitimately turned-up mouth. Bosch handed the photo to Edgar and looked at Delacroix, who had returned to the couch. "Those stairs. Was that taken here?"
"Yes, this is the home we grew up in."
"When he disappeared, it was from here?"
"Yes."
"Are any of his belongings still here in the house?" Delacroix smiled sadly and shook her head.
"No, it's all gone. I gave his things to the charity rummage sale at church. That was a long time ago."
"What church is that?"
"The Wilshire Church of Nature."
Bosch just nodded.
"They're the ones who don't let you have coffee?" Edgar asked. "Nothing with caffeine."
Edgar put the framed photo down next to his tea. "Do you have any other photos of him?" he asked.
"Of course. I have a box of old photos."
"Can we look at those? You know, while we talk?" Delacroix's eyebrows came together in confusion. "Sheila," Bosch said, "we found some clothing with the remains. We would like to look at the photos to see if any of it matches. It will help the investigation." She nodded.
"I see. Well, then I'll be right back. I just need to go to the closet in the hallway."
"Do you need help?"
"No, I can manage."
After she was gone, Edgar leaned over to Bosch and whispered,
This Church of Nature tea tastes like piss water.
Bosch whispered back,
How would you know what piss water tastes like?
The skin around Edgar's eyes drew tight with embarrassment as he realized he had walked into that one. Before he could muster a response, Sheila Delacroix came back into the room carrying an old shoebox. She put it down on the coffee table and removed the lid. The box was filled with loose photographs.
These aren't in any order or anything, but he should be in a lot of them.
Bosch nodded to Edgar, who reached into the box for the first stack of photos.
While my partner looks through these, why don't you tell me about your brother and when he disappeared?
Sheila nodded and composed her thoughts before beginning.
May 4th, 1980. He didn't come home from school. That's it. That's all.
We thought he had run away.
You said you found clothes with the remains.
Well, my father looked in his drawers and said that Arthur had taken clothes.
That was what made us think he had run away.
Bosch wrote a few notes down in a notebook he had pulled from his coat pocket.
You mentioned that he had been injured a few months before on a skateboard.
Yes, he hit his head and they had to operate.
When he disappeared, did he take his skateboard?
She thought about this for a long moment.
It was so long ago. All I know is that he loved that board, so I think he probably took it. But I just remember the clothes. My father found some of his clothes missing.
Did you report him missing?
I was 16 years old at the time, so I didn't do anything. My father talked to the police, though, I'm sure of it.
I couldn't find any record of Arthur being reported missing. Are you sure he reported him missing?
I drove with him to the police station.
Was it Wilshire Division?
I would assume, but I don't really remember.
Sheila, where is your father? Is he still alive?
He's alive. He lives in the valley, but he's not well these days.
Where in the valley?
Van Nuys, in the Manchester Trailer Park.
There was silence while Bosch wrote the information down. He had been to the Manchester Trailer Park before on investigations. It wasn't a pleasant place to live.
He drinks.
Bosch looked at her.
Ever since Arthur.
Bosch nodded that he understood. Edgar leaned forward and handed him a photograph. It was a yellowed 3x5. It showed a young boy, his arms raised in an effort to maintain balance, gliding on the sidewalk on a skateboard. The angle of the photograph showed little of the skateboard other than its profile. Bosch could not tell if it carried a bone design on it or not.
Can't see much there, he said, as he started to hand the photo back.
No, the clothes. The shirt.
Bosch looked at the photo again. Edgar was right. The boy in the photo wore a gray t-shirt with Solid Surf printed across the chest.
Bosch showed the photo to Sheila.
This is your brother, right?
She leaned forward to look at the photo.
Yes, definitely.
That shirt he's wearing, do you remember if it is one of the pieces of clothing your father found missing?
Delacroix shook her head.
I can't remember. It's been... I just remember that he liked that shirt a lot.
Bosch nodded and gave the photo back to Edgar. It wasn't the kind of solid confirmation they could get from x-rays and bone comparison, but it was one more notch. Bosch was feeling more and more sure that they were about to identify the bones. He watched Edgar put the photo in a short stack of pictures he intended to borrow from Sheila's collection. Bosch checked his watch and looked back at Sheila.
What about your mother?
Sheila immediately shook her head.
Nope. She was long gone by the time all of this happened.
You mean she died?
I mean, she took a bus the minute the going got tough. You see, Arthur was a difficult child, right from the beginning. He needed a lot of attention, and it fell to my mother. After a while, she couldn't take it any longer. One night, she went out to get some medicine at the drugstore, and she never came back. We found little notes from her under our pillows.
Bosch dropped his eyes to his notebook. It was hard to hear this story and keep looking at Sheila Delacroix.
How old were you?
How old was your brother?
I was 6, so that would make Artie 2.
Bosch nodded. Did you keep the note from her?
No. There was no need. I didn't need a reminder of how she supposedly loved us, but not enough to stay with us.
What about Arthur? Did he keep his?
Well, he was only 2, so my father kept it for him. He gave it to him when he was older. He may have kept it, I don't know. Because he never really knew her, he was always very interested in what she was like. He asked me a lot of questions about her. There were no photos of her. My father had gotten rid of them all so he wouldn't have any reminders.
Do you know what happened to her? Or if she's still alive?
I haven't the faintest idea. And to tell you the truth, I don't care if she's alive or not.
What is her name?
Christine Dorset Delacroix. Dorset was her maiden name.
Do you know her birth date or social security number? Sheila shook her head. Do you have your own birth certificate handy here?
It's somewhere in my records. I could go look for it.
She started to get up. No, wait. We can look for that at the end. I'd like to keep talking here.
Okay.
After your mother was gone, did your father remarry?
No, he never did. He lives alone now.
Did he ever have a girlfriend? Someone who might have stayed in the house?
She looked at Bosch with eyes that seemed almost lifeless. No, she said. Never.
Bosch decided to move on to an area of discussion that would be less difficult for her. What school did your brother go to?
At the end, he was going to the Brethren.
Bosch didn't say anything. He wrote the name of the school down on his pad and then a large letter B beneath it. He circled the letter, thinking about the backpack. Sheila continued, unbidden.
It was a private school for troubled boys. My dad paid to send him there. It's off of Crescent Heights near Pico. It's still there.
Why did he go there? I mean, why was he considered troubled?
Because he got kicked out of his other schools for fighting, mostly.
Fighting? Edgar said.
That's right.
Edgar picked the top photograph off of his keeper file and studied it for a moment. This boy looks like he was as light as smoke. Was he the one starting these fights?
Most times. He had trouble getting along. All he wanted to do was be on his skateboard. I think that by today's standards, he would be diagnosed as having attention deficit disorder or something similar. He just wanted to be by himself all the time.
Did he get hurt in these fights? Bosch asked.
Sometimes. Black and blue, mostly.
Broken bones?
Not that I remember. Just schoolyard fights.
Bosch felt agitated. The information they were getting could point them in many different directions. He had hoped a clear-cut path might emerge from the interview. You said your father searched the drawers in your brother's room and found clothes missing.
That's right.
Not a lot.
Just a few things.
Any idea what was missing, specifically? She shook her head.
I can't remember.
What did he take the clothes in? Like a suitcase or something?
I think he took his school bag. Took out the books and put in some clothes.
Do you remember what that looked like?
No. Just a backpack. Everybody had to use the same thing at the Brethren. I still see kids walking on Pico with them, the backpacks with the B on the back.
Bosch glanced at Edgar, and then back at Delacroix. Let's go back to the skateboard. Are you sure he took it with him? She paused to think about this, then slowly nodded.
Yes, I'm pretty sure he took it with him.
Bosch decided to cut off the interview and concentrate on completing the identification. Once they confirmed the bones came from Arthur Delacroix, then they could come back to his sister. He thought about Gallagher's take on the injuries to the bones. Chronic abuse. Could it all have been injuries from schoolyard fights and skateboarding?
He knew he needed to approach the issue of child abuse, but did not feel the time was appropriate. He also didn't want to tip his hand to the daughter so that she could turn around and possibly tell the father. What Bosch wanted was to back out and come back in later, when he felt he had a tighter grasp on the case and a solid investigative plan to go with.
Okay, we're going to wrap things up here pretty quickly, Sheila. Just a few more questions. Did Arthur have some friends? Maybe a best friend, someone he might confide in?
She shook her head.
Not really. He mostly was by himself.
Bosch nodded and was about to close his notebook when she continued.
There was one boy he'd go boarding with. His name was Johnny Stokes. He was from somewhere down near Pico. He was bigger and a little bit older than Arthur, but they were in the same class at the Brethren. My father was pretty sure he smoked pot, so we didn't like Arthur being friends with him.
By we, you mean your dad and you?
Yes, my father. He was upset about it.
Did either of you talk to Johnny Stokes after Arthur went missing?
Yes. That night when he didn't come home, my father called Johnny Stokes, but he said he hadn't seen Artie. The next day, when Dad went to the school to ask about him, he told me he talked to Johnny again about Artie.
And what did he say?
That he hadn't seen him.
Bosch wrote down the friend's name in his notebook and underlined it.
Any other friends you can think of?
No, not really.
What's your father's name?
Samuel. Are you going to talk to him?
Most likely. Her eyes dropped to the hands clasped in her lap. Is that a problem if we talk to him?
Not really. He's just not well. If those bones turn out to be Arthur... I was thinking it would be better if he didn't ever know.
We'll keep that in mind when we talk to him. But we won't do it until we have a positive identification.
But if you talk to him, then he'll know.
It may be unavoidable, Sheila. Edgar handed Bosch another photo. It showed Arthur standing next to a tall, blonde man who looked faintly familiar to Bosch. He showed the photo to Sheila. Is this your father?
Yes, it's him.
He looks familiar.
Was he ever... He's an actor.
Was, actually. He was on some television shows in the 60s and a few things after that. Some movie parts. Not enough to make a living?
No, he always had to work other jobs, so he could live.
Bosch nodded and handed the photo back to Edgar, but Sheila reached across the coffee table and intercepted it.
I don't want that one to leave, please. I don't have many photos of my father.
Fine, Bosch said. Could we go look for the birth certificate now?
I'll go look. You can stay here.
She got up and left the room again, and Edgar took the opportunity to show Bosch some of the other photos he had taken to keep during the investigation.
It's him, Harry, he whispered. I got no doubt.
He showed him a photo of Arthur Delacroix that had apparently been taken for school. His hair was combed neatly, and he wore a blue blazer and tie. Bosch studied the boy's eyes. They reminded him of the photo of the boy from Kosovo he had found in Nicholas Trent's house. The boy with a thousand-yard stare.
I found it.
Sheila Delacroix came into the room carrying an envelope and unfolding a yellowed document. Bosch looked at it for a moment, and then copied down the names, birth dates, and social security numbers of her parents. Thanks, he said. You and Arthur had the same parents, right?
Of course.
Okay, Sheila, thank you. We're going to go. We'll call you as soon as we know something for sure. He stood up, and so did Edgar.
All right if we borrow these photos? Edgar asked. I will personally see that you get them back.
Okay, if you need them.
They headed to the door, and she opened it. While still on the threshold, Bosch asked her one last question. Sheila, have you always lived here? She nodded.
All my life. I've stayed here in case he comes back, you know.
in case he doesn't know where to start and comes here.
She smiled,